With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. It's me, Simon Hughes, on my own today because Simon Mann is still wending his way back from South Africa from that brilliant three-match T20 series which England sneaked at the last. And Owen Morgan, what incredible hitting he produced there. Seven sixes in that final innings, which took his sixth tally in T20 National, so over 100. 105 sixes by Owen Morgan to go with his 211 sixes in ODI cricket. And just one little thing actually about his six hitting I've noticed is that firstly he holds the bat very high up the handle, so there's quite a gap between his bottom hand and the splice, which just gives him that little bit of extra leverage and therefore distance, very similar actually to the way Adam Gilchrist used to hold the bat. And the other thing is, he doesn't hit the ball miles over the rope. He just sort of hits it almost creeping over the rope for six, just enough to clear the fielders, mostly. And he keeps his shape when he hits the ball. He doesn't kind of throw himself off balance. It's just a lovely flowing movement, hitting it just enough to get the six, rather than into the 18th row. You don't get any more for powering the ball onto the roof. And he really sort of does show the value of keeping control of your shot making. It did really underline the brilliance of that T20 format in England's victory, and I guess it's shaping up well. They're shaping up well for the T20 World Cup in November in Australia. Okay, well, in this episode today, I'm investigating a rather dark and more mysterious but fairly topical subject: mental health in cricket. With more and more money coming into the game and its continually rising profile, mental health seems to become a bigger and bigger issue in cricket and sport in general. Your mental well-being is becoming almost as important, perhaps even more important, than your physical condition. In fact, mental health generally seems to become a huge topic, especially in the workplace. Everybody seems to be suffering from stress of one sort or another. The almost intolerable pressures on high-profile personalities, the intense scrutiny, the incessant social media attention, the invasions on their privacy, had a truly tragic context at the weekend with the Love Island presenter Caroline Flack taking her own life. It's a devastatingly sad story. I suppose it's partly a product of a general obsession with celebrity. Although no modern cricketers have gone to the drastic lengths that Caroline Flack did, it's a sport associated with suicide. Three players I knew well, including David Bairstow, of course, took their own life, and there have been many others over the years, actually over 100. There is even a book about suicides in cricket written by David Frith, if you're of that sort of persuasion to read that kind of thing. We've had a number of recent cases of top players retiring from internationals or requesting a break for mental health reasons. the most high profile of which, of course, was Australia's Glenn Maxwell in November. And we shouldn't forget either that the brilliant England women's player Sarah Taylor announced her retirement from the international game last September for the same reason. So I decided to try and find out exactly what the pressures on the modern players are. What are the symptoms of poor mental health, and what are some possible cures? In the next few minutes, we'll hear from a leading coach, former Australian batsman Stuart Law, now in charge at Middlesex, a prominent player, the new Essex captain Tom Westley, and two leading sports psychologists, both working in the professional game. Hopefully, they can make some sense of a complex issue. But first, a personal story. It's something like 25 years since I reported late to training at Lourdes for Middlesex. It was early season. In fact, it was the day of the photo call when all the press and photographers come and take your picture and the team poses with whatever trophies they might have won the previous year, and you give a few interviews and stand for a few profile pictures and so on. Anyway, I was about an hour late, and I had good reason to be an hour late. Everybody's saying, well, where the hell have you been? But actually, I'd been dealing with my wife's situation. She had decided that she didn't love me anymore and that she was leaving for another man. And so we sort of thrashed it out overnight and into the early morning to try and figure out the best way forward. We parted and she left and went off to live with this other guy. And I was obviously late for training and for this photo call. And when I arrived, everyone was saying, well, where the hell have you been? Why are you late again? And for once, I sort of reacted, instead of just apologising, I said, look, don't even start. My wife has just announced that she's in love with another man and she's leaving me. And so there was a bit of sort of silence and one or two people just kind of chuntering away. And then someone said, well, you're not exactly Richard Gere, are you? And, I mean, you look, I had to laugh in the end. There was certainly no sympathy and there was no point in dwelling on it. But I think it pretty much did affect my season. There was a feeling of sort of rejection and loneliness and occasionally probably depression. I didn't have a very good season. And in the end, actually, I was released by Middlesex at the end of that season. Now, I'm not blaming my ex-wife on that, but there was no one really to talk to about it. You just had to get on with the job. And it's good that, you know, now the situation is totally different. Life has changed and these kind of things can be much more better dealt with. Now, before I carry on any more of that sob story, I thought we should move on to the modern day, and I thought Stuart Law would be an excellent person to kick off this discussion of cricketer's mental health, as, like me, he played in a less forgiving era under the captaincy of Alan Border in Australia and for Queensland, and he played plenty of county cricket too, and more recently has coached both the West Indies and Bangladesh national teams before taking over at Middlesex. He's got a good grasp on how the awareness of a player's mental state is more acute than it used to be.
To think back when we played, it wasn't common knowledge what we were going through. If we had a stage in our careers where we weren't scoring the runs we should do, we just thought it was a bad patch, you know, you're out of form. But because of the information now that has been gathered, the research that's been done on the subject, you know, I'm sure that at some stage we've all gone through symptoms of, or actually got it a little bit worse, of mental illness. You know, thinking bad, you know, it's become too tough. You know, it's probably left a bit of a hole for us, the older players. But the younger generation now growing up, they're surrounded by fantastic people. You've got, you know, your sports psychologists, you've got doctors, sports doctors. You've got anything you need. And it's up to us as coaches now to identify if a player is okay, which can be tough as well because sometimes players are very closed book. But we utilise those other avenues we've got, the sports psychs, to work out a profile of character. When they're going well, this is how they behave. When they're going poorly, this is how they behave. And you weigh it up and then you start asking questions.
Is it the job of the coach to identify this, or is it the job of the player to approach the coach with it?
Look, I think it's a bit of both. You know, I've had dealings with some players in, you know, other teams where, you know, you sort of ask them the question, are you all right? You know, is everything okay? How's life at home? And they put up a front. And they say, yeah, no, everything's good. And if they're normally the life and soul of a dressing room and, you know, up and you know, the talkative one or the telling joke one, and they all of a sudden they sit in the corner and go, I'm very quiet. You know, there's something's completely wrong. But they're not the ones to come out. After a while, not in a group scenario, you might just say, let's go and have a coffee, sit down, have a chat. And, you know, I've had players that have just sat there and burst into tears. You know, and you go, right, okay, we've hit something, and then you can put things in place. Then you can say, right, this player needs to see, you know, the doc, the psych, and there's a process in place to help deal with that. But players are nowadays they're more willing and more open to come out to come forward with their issues, and we've just seen great examples of that back home in Australia with you know, Glenn Maxwell. Is the number one or the biggest player to have come out and openly said it, which is, you know, fantastic work from Glenn, but also great work from Victoria and Cricket Australia to identify that he was going through some issues that he didn't know how to deal with.
So, as Stuart Law says there's clearly a lot more sensitivity to a player's mental condition than there used to be. But what are the pressures on the modern player actually like, and how are they affected by them? I thought I'd ask Essex's Tom Westley this, as he, of course, was piloted into England's problem number three spot in 2017, had a tough summer against the swinging ball propelled by a very potent South African attack, and was then dropped. He accepts he didn't perform as he'd hoped, but he still found his disappointment almost overpowering the following season. I asked him how he overcame it.
The 2018 season was sort of, it was a, you know, accumulation of like many low points really. And it actually got to the point where, you know, I actually sat down with Tendo, who's captain at the time and a close friend, and actually the head coach, Anthony McGrath, who's, you know, he's got a brilliant relationship with all the Essex boys. And I just said to him, like, I'm struggling for like motivation here. And you know, maybe that wasn't, you know, that might not always appear the smartest thing to do is go to the captain and go to their coach saying that I'm struggling to sort of get up for games at the moment. But it was testament to my relationship with them that I felt that I could speak to them. And you know, Max was, like, and Tendo were outstanding. Max actually said to me he wished that I'd spoke to him a lot sooner, because obviously he went through the same process of, you know, being dropped for England as many players do, and I'm sure it affects everyone in different ways, but for me, because I've always tried to maintain a certain amount of like level-headedness and composure, it was just a bit, I just felt, and I said to Max, I just felt very deflated, and I felt deflated for quite a long period of time actually, and it wasn't until I probably actually, you know, spoke about the subject with Tendo and Max that it sort of alleviated a lot of the problems. Mag suggested that I make a list of, you know, why I play cricket. You know, the positives, the negatives, and he said there's no negative. He's like, if it's something, you know, like if it's a financial reason or it to feed your ego, you know, whatever it is, just put it down. And then, you know, once I started working through it, getting a bit more structure, practicing the way that I had been, what got me to England, then obviously I had a little bit more success on the field. I finished that season, the 2018 season, with a couple of hundreds, which were, if I'm being completely honest, they didn't feel the same, but it was still rewarding. But it was just that, you know, almost going back to the beginning, like, why do I play cricket? You know, because I, you know, it's as simple as, you know, loving the sound of like middling the cricket ball, or whether it is like raising your bat to your friends and family in the crowd for a 50 or 100, but just actually maybe acknowledging all the positives as well as some of the negatives, I slowly started to regain that sort of that motivation and hunger.
The media intrusion and scrutiny is certainly ramped up when you play international sport. It goes with the territory, I suppose, and the players have learnt to expect a greater level of interaction and comment. You try and ignore the negative stuff, of course, but it's not always that easy, as Westley remembers.
Well, you're as prepared as best as you can with the England line setup. You know, we have meetings and we have, you know, some excellent coaches, Andy Flower, Graham Thorpe, and they give workshops on those sort of things. But actually, I think until you're in it, you don't really know how you're going to cope. But one bit of advice that Graham Thorpe, I remember, spoke about was that if he knew that he'd played well, you know, he would maybe follow some of the media stories and boost his ego. And everyone knows when when you're doing poorly. But you know that you're going to maybe be getting hammered in the media, so you avoid it. So I tried to sort of follow that mantle, but unfortunately I didn't really have much success, so I wasn't really getting much praise. So I set out, obviously, to ignore all the media and stuff. But what is tough is when some of your like closest friends and family, without realising, like say my mum, for example, can you believe what like Shane Warne said in the paper about you? I was like, well, actually, mum, I haven't looked at it, but then ultimately you do have a look at it.
Bloody mothers, you just can't trust them, can you? But especially for the younger generation, a compulsion towards engaging with social media seems to only have a downside, according to Stuart Law.
Sometimes you see the players, the first thing they do at end of a day's play, they go through their Twitter feed or, you know, some social media feed, and, you know, there might be one, two, there might be a thousand saying how bad you are. You've got to deal with that, you know, and even though you think, well, I didn't have a great day today, yeah, that one's right, yeah, this one's pretty funny. If you keep going through and keep reading them like people do, it's going to start playing on your mind. You know, you keep getting told you're not very good, you're going to start believing you're not very good. So it's a tough world, mate, in a sense that you're being scrutinised by, you know, the people around you, the people who are guiding your career, selectors, management, coaches, what have you, your teammates. But then you've got the public perception, and there's some horrible people out there, keyboard warriors who, you know, just sit there and say something without thinking it through or not really caring about it, just want to get a reaction. And, you know, unfortunately, the reaction that they're getting these days is, you know, there's some kids in some pretty serious trouble. I encourage any player who plays the game, ditch your social media while you're a player. Trying to tell a kid to delete all your apps off your phone and use your phone just for making calls and sending a text to, you know, your friends and family, that doesn't happen.
So they don't take any notice?
Well, they don't because it's their life, isn't it? They've grown up completely different to us. And I get that now. It took me a while. I've got an 18-year-old son who goes through the same process. You know, comes home and he sits there and looks at his, you know, social media feed, and, you know, that's what they do. So you can't just switch that off.
The trouble is, Twitter especially seems to become, as one paper commenting on the Caroline Flack case put it, a force for recreational cruelty. People sheltered behind their anonymity will say practically anything to get a reaction. While, of course, I'm not comparing the tweets I get to the level of abuse she often suffered, I have had my share of flack. Like a few death threats, literally. People saying I should be sacked for things I said, being labelled as a total idiot. And comments like one guy who said after some analysis I did on TV that your opinion of what might have happened has no more relevance or authority than my mother-in-law's chihuahua. Nice, when you try and laugh it off. But it does get you eventually, and I suppose make you begin to wonder if all this social media engagement is really worthwhile. OK, so we've heard from an international coach and a player about the issues affecting cricketers' mental well-being. I thought it was also interesting to talk to some psychologists who've worked in a number of sports, including cricket, who could perhaps identify why cricketers in particular might suffer from mental health problems. So to begin with, here is Andrea First, an Australian sports psychologist who works regularly with Surrey and was also closely involved with the Olympic gold medal winning GB women's hockey team, as well as various other international athletes. She thinks that one of the aspects that makes a top cricketer's life that much more mentally demanding is the time away from home.
There are longer periods of time where particularly those that are involved in national duty and or club and or franchise, their schedules are busy and they're away from home probably more than most athletes, and outside their the comfort of the people that they would, you know, spend time with, whether it be their own mentors, coaches, you know, it could be their family, friends, etc.
Is that sort of an element of homesickness partly?
Definitely there would be athletes that feel homesick. But I think it's just also the fact that, you know, if people were asked to be in their workplace for, let's say, high 200s in terms of days a year, and with rest days that are often spent with teammates or work colleagues, and if you're in an office space, I think most people would go, that's a little different. That's different to being, you know, the extreme where it might be a, you know, probably not typical anymore, but a 9 to 5 where I'm, you know, sleeping in my own bed, eating meals with my family or friends or whoever it might be consistently, and have a routine that's very comfortable. And then you've got, in addition to that, the anxiety around performance, which is no different to any other sport. You know, being in that environment and needing to, you know, compete and train well, you've got, you know, the eyes of your selectors and your teammates watching you pretty much 24/7. So if you're in a hotel with your team, then, you know, people aren't just able to have breakfast without, you know, some eyes of staff watching them, not necessarily every move they make, but it's far from the confines of your own home where you can completely relax. So you're on a lot. If, do you understand what I mean by on? Like on as in, you know, if you think about your nervous system, you're probably in that potentially that fight and flight stage rather than rest and digest. And that's the bit that we've got to teach athletes to do when they're away, is to make sure they give back to themselves. They have ways that they can recover, disengage, decompress, all those sort of buzz terms. There are lots of the things that we're working on, you know, with athletes, particularly the ones on the road. It's not that this is an issue for every player, but particularly at the highest level, it is the amount of travel and time away consecutively, in addition to the fact that the game itself, particularly in the test form, is long in duration. So you can be out fielding for a long time, bowling for a long time, batting for a long time, or you could be sitting watching for a long time. So there's the ability to be able to you know, stay engaged and on, because you definitely don't want people switching off while they're on camp, you know, away from training, away from competition, because they're there to do a job. But you also need to have that ability. It's almost like having different gears for different parts of their life. Whereas, you know, when you drive it, you know, vice versa, if you're driving the driveway or pull up the car at home and you're going to home, yeah, there might be a little bit of thinking about other people, but you can definitely relax and decompress a lot more.
Is it a more demanding sport to work in as a sports psychologist than other sports for those reasons that you mentioned?
I think it's more that it's a sport that has traditionally been, I guess, quite social. So its professionalism is kind of catching up. The acceptance of what sports psychology is, or what psychology is, or what talking about their mind is, or talking about mental health is, like, that is probably lagging behind. You know, if I look at all the time I spent in golf, they've welcomed sports psychology and psychology with open arms for many, many years. Again, there's still players that don't like it, don't use it, but it's more accepted, and it's been more accepted for years.
So some good practical advice there from Andrea First, which I suppose could be valuable to manage stress in any walk of life, not just cricket. Sounds like she's a valuable asset to all those star players at Surrey. And I know Liam Plunkett found her very helpful when he was trying to deal with the rather more mundane realities of day-to-day life after the euphoria of winning the World Cup last year. Another Australian sports psychologist, Graham Winter, who was also a former first-class player, has written a book, Mindful Cricket, which explores how you create and get into an appropriate mindset to cope with cricket's unusual demands, which of course include that unique thing, for a batsman anyway, that you are only one tiny mistake or good ball or brilliant catch away from your day or match being over.
In order to try to address, you know, what is a game mindset, we looked at it from two angles. One was obviously the successful players and the research around success, but we also looked at and we just ended up calling them the enemies. What are the things that cause you to not play so well? And they pretty clearly came out as a reactive mind, so being very reactive to the environment you're in and emotions going up and down and so on. Second was being distracted, which is obviously your attention. The third was then making things more complicated, and the fourth was being slow to adapt. And it was interesting when you looked at the athletes, and I'm sure we can all do it, when you look at the cricketers, for example, who play well, they bring a clear mind, and a clear mind is composed, not reactive. You know, it's focused on the task now. It's not distracted. It's simple in the sense that they will be focused on one thing, one task, next thing to do, and they'll be adapting. So to me, a lot of it is understanding what the things are. And I guess I learned this with Olympic athletes over the years, that it's not a case to some extent of trying to get it, what's my perfect performance. It's trying to eliminate the impediments and then see what happens. So if we can develop the ability of the player to have a clearer mind, and I mean, certainly most of the test cricketers, first class cricketers I've worked with, when it all comes down to it, they will, when they talk about their best performance, they'll say, my mind was clear. And then when you ask them, what does that mean? They'll say usually two things. I was composed or at the right sort of energy level, and I was really just absorbed in the task. You watch an athlete and they're in control of their own space around them, their routines, their rituals, their actions, the pace they do things at. That they have a way of doing it. You know, like a Steve Smith will do it differently to a Joe Root, but they will have a way of owning their space, and it's consistent.
So that was Graham Winter, who's also worked with Olympic athletes as well as cricketers, and much of his book is focused on how to get into that calm, composed state. He calls it a sort of cocoon, to be able to perform at your best. Interestingly, a problem he identifies with cricket is that there's a wild disparity between the practice facilities, i.e. the nets, which can be quite claustrophobic and unrealistic, and the playing environment, in other words, the pitch.
I think one of the most telling issues with cricket is that there are not many sports that have such a difference in the competitive environment. So in other words, out in the middle on a cricket ground, and the practice environment, which we see in the nets. And I don't believe that coaches come to grips with that very well. For example, we were running some match simulations in some nets last week, and the senior coach knew what we were doing, was thinking this is fantastic. Two other coaches were quite concerned the players weren't facing enough deliveries, and came over and said, look, you know, we need three bowlers in this net. And we said, well, what we're doing is we're replicating match conditions. And they said, yeah, but the batsmen need to be hitting more balls. And we go, well, hang on a minute, we've got the bowlers bowling in six ball increments, we're having the batsmen practice their routines as they would in a game. Why do you want to now deliver three times the number of deliveries that they would get in the game? They said, well, they need to feel bad on ball. And I think cricket coaches are struggling with this concept of how do you create a practice environment where, yes, you want some time to do net practice in its traditional sense of bat on ball or bowling a lot of deliveries, but you also want some time to practice how you own your space and how you hold your shape. I think that's one piece of it. And then I think the second piece is culturally, cricket still, I look at even the first class teams here, they do not have, when you look at their program and say, show me your program for the week, they do not have anything that is around mental skills, mindfulness or so on, built into their weekly routine. You would not find an Olympic team that hasn't got that. So I think there's both the physical environment. We're not going away from the nets, but we can use them better. And we're doing some work with Root Academy here in Australia with their high performance program. They've got a great setup here where they run a lot of that simulated drills and developing what I'd say is they're practicing how to play cricket. They're not just practicing how to hit a cricket ball or bowl a cricket ball.
So Graham Winter implying there that Joe Root's academy is thinking very broad-mindedly about how they're developing players for the future. And if there's one thing that makes Joe Root stand out from the crowd, apart from his skill, of course, it's his generally relaxed posture and obvious love of the game. He's always smiling, well, mostly anyway, and he seems to rarely forget how much fun it is to be a cricketer. It's a wonderful life overall, a privilege to be playing such a great game and be paid for the pleasure. And that is Tom Westley's coping mechanism and overriding message.
I've always said to myself, like, the day that I actually do view this as a job is probably the day that I shouldn't be playing anymore. I think we're blessed. The lifestyle that it gives you, the countries that you get to see and the friends and experiences that you get to go through is that there are a lot of the things that I put down as positives for being a cricketer. You need to, and I think this is where Essex have been so successful, is actually buying into something like bigger than just yourself. I know Graham Gooch speaks a lot about, it's not always, I know he scored obviously thousands and thousands of runs, but he wants to be remembered of how many games of cricket he won, how many games of cricket he won for Essex or for England. And I think that's because as a batsman, you know, it's very easy to be perceived as selfish. I think if you can be a selfless cricketer and be and hopefully look back on your career having won things rather than averaging five more and having won nothing, I think that's a much better and healthier mentality to have for not only yourself, but for the team. I was fortunate that I studied a bit of this. My dissertation revolved a little bit around it in cricket, and one of my best friends also did a dissertation in cricket into suicide, which was quite a hard-to-read piece. And a lot of it focused around your identity. And a lot of people, I think, cricketers in particular, you know, they create their identity because of their profession. They're a cricketer. So I think if you can accept that you're a cricketer and it's a great job and it's brilliant, but actually have things outside of cricket, enjoy other people's success and try and be level-headed, I think that helps your sort of mental well-being and health.
Great attitude from Tom Wesley. Sounds like Essex have chosen their new captain well. Should be fun watching them this season. So I hope that's given you some insight into the mind of the modern cricketer and the pressures they have to deal with. I guess my two main takeouts would be develop an interest outside the game. Mine was always writing, actually. And turn that phone off. There's more on this subject in the forthcoming issue of the Cricketer magazine, including an interview with the former Derbyshire and Lancashire wicketkeeper Luke Sutton, whose recently published book, Back from the Edge, recounts traumatically how he was in the Priory Rehab Clinic, aged 35. You can subscribe at www.thecricketer.com/subscribe, and we also have an exclusive interview with ECB Chief Executive Tom Harrison talking about the future of Test cricket and the likelihood of new city teams in the 100 in the near future. And in the next podcast, later this week, we'll have some extracts from that interview. And if you like this podcast, please review it on iTunes or recommend it to a friend, or send us your thoughts on mental health in cricket to theanalystpodcast@gmail.com. It'd be great to hear from you. And thanks very much for listening. Speak to you later in the week.
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.